Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lisa's Book Divas, where you'll get a sneak peek into the lives behind the authors, celebrities, and entertainers that you love to read about. Sit back, relax, and let Lisa and her guests entertain you. And now, your Book Divas host, Lisa LC.
Appreciate you coming on again. We had some technical difficulties due to my error last week, and I apologize to anybody who tuned in last week. That was me. I did it. I'm the one. So we're back this week with even a better show, stronger show, and Caitlin's going to talk to us a little bit about this new book, Transcendent. How is that book doing so far? Have you heard anything back yourself on sales or feedback? What are you getting from people?
I try to avoid that as much as possible, especially in the early days, just because I feel like, you know, in the same way, if you see, you know, a bad comment on Goodreads or something like that, it can really, you know, set you back and make you less inspired to be doing things and to be writing new things. So I kind of just focus more on all the positive feedback that comes in and, you know, all the little messages from a reader who tells you, you know, how important your book was. Like, that's what I like to think about.
Well, that's good. That's good. I don't know. I read all my feedback. I don't care if it's good or bad. I mean, of course it hurts if it's bad. It always does. It's a funny story because just right before we started the show, I don't even know how that message got onto my iTunes box. I just heard a message for a book that had all these typos in it, and it's like, but I didn't even publish that book. That was a different publisher. I just bought the imprints. But I mean, what a way to psych you out right before your interview, huh? And it's like, well,
yeah, that's terrible.
Things like that happen. And you're never gonna please everybody. So you just gotta keep. What do you tell people? I mean, I tell them just keep going on. Don't even look back. There's only forward. Just keep going forward. You know?
Yeah, it's true. And I think we'll probably talk about it later. But being on the literary agenting side of it too, I think I have a thicker skin just because I've had to develop it over the years too of, you know, submitting projects for things I love. And if it gets rejected, it's the same kind of thing as, you know, seeing something negative about my book. Like, it's all personal. So I think I've seen enough of it that I can brush it off a little bit more easily.
Well, I guess I didn't think of that, but with you being an agent, are people ultra critical of you? Like, well, I thought you weren't supposed to open a book this way, or I thought you weren't supposed to open with the weather, or I thought you weren't supposed to open with them traveling.
You know, if they're saying that, it's behind my back. I don't know if that's better or worse. I feel like I've gotten that ever since college, really, and being an English major, you know, friends who get super paranoid when they're, you know, typing an email to you or texting you, like, oh, my grammar, I messed up that word, that's so embarrassing, like, you're an English major. So I do feel like there's always kind of that expectation that people think, because you work with books all the time, like, you never make mistakes, and that's not true at all.
So do you actually use a spell check on your Gmail or your email program?
Oh, I need it all the time. I mean, I feel like between, you know, the red squiggle on that and Word, it just totally kind of ruins your spelling because you get so lazy. There's so many basic words I feel like I could probably spell when I was in middle school that are slipping
yeah.
Now.
I'm more of a send it and go, oh, what did I type? And then go back and resend it. Sorry about all the typos. And when I got my iPhone, I was all thumbs, and I'm like, everybody's laughing. I mean, they could do a whole book on my typos.
well, it feels more authentic.
That's a whole other thing. Well, tell us a little bit about you growing up, and we had a different point. We were going to start with the book here, but I think I want to hear a little bit about you growing up and how you got into the writing process. I heard you had read or lived in an old farmhouse, and I can just see it, I mean, just from the description. But tell us what it was like growing up.
Yeah, I grew up in a very small town in PA. It's about an hour northwest of Philly and like a half hour plus from a decent mall and movie theater and, you know, civilization quite like that. But I really loved it, and I still go back like at least once a month. I'm in Brooklyn now, so it's about 2 hours. But, yeah, super small town, and I played outside so much growing up, and I really credit that to a lot of my love of storytelling, because we didn't watch a ton of TV, and my mom, you know, bought a lot more like wooden toys and like kits for things like make your own perfume or make your own restaurant. So it was a lot more imagination required for what we did. And I had friends who we played outside all the time. We played really elaborate games of house, like, you know, like actually making mud pies and things like that. And I wasn't writing a ton at that age. Like, you know, I had like a little construction paper book, Henrietta the Turkey, that my mom still breaks out every Thanksgiving. But beyond that, I wasn't necessarily thinking about writing. And even in high school, I think I wrote one creative story for a class, and that was really it. And then I went to college thinking I was going to do journalism, because I thought that was the most practical thing to do with my love of just reading. And I knew I loved to write, but I'd only really written like school essays at that point. But worked for the newspaper for a year at Penn State, and just realized I hated the news and working with the news, and switched to English. And then I worked at Penn State Press for 2 years in the marketing department as an intern. And then, you know, when I graduated, I knew I had to be in New York if I wanted to do something in publishing, which at that point just felt like the only kind of sensible book-related way forward. And was lucky enough to get a job in marketing for a big children's company for 2 years, and then I liked that, and I saw things I liked more, and the agency side is what really appealed to me. So I've been doing that for 6 years now and love it, and was doing this for a few years and just seeing so much, you know, so much great YA, and it just got my brain thinking about things I could possibly do, and just kind of started on a lark, not knowing what would happen, and then told my boss, my agent about it, which was terrifying, and it kind of went from there. So I wasn't really sure I wanted to write until I was in publishing and just surrounded by words all the time.
It kind of is like an addiction, though, I think. I think anybody mm-hmm. that works in publishing eventually, I mean, I know tons of editors that all have that book in the back, and at some point, I hope they all do bring them out, because you hear about them, and you know, I want to see everything in print. That's my problem. I want to see everything kept in print too.
I hear you.
You know what I mean? It's, I don't think the shelf life is as long. And I
no,
think
it's really not.
You know, it needs to be forever. I mean, and I know everybody's kind of like in their rights grab thing, where, you know, hey, my book's been out 3 years. I want my book rights back. But you know, wow, that publisher can do so much for you, keeping that book in print mm-hmm. for years, years and years. That's the way I look at it, anyway. And
yeah,
I don't know. What? Maybe you've got a different outlook on that or not.
It's so hard. I mean, if the book's kind of languishing, you kind of want to pry it away from the publisher, because, you know, love or hate ebooks at this point, like, they do exist permanently if that's what you choose, and do give people an outlet to find the books, where, you know, the printed book might be nearly impossible to find. Or there's ways, you know, to print them still, even if you keep the rights, you know, from Amazon and whatnot. So at least there's other possibilities, and the book can kind of live on in different ways.
What's the hardest part about being both an agent and an author? I mean, do you find yourself having to give authors advice that you yourself are not sure you'd want to take, but you're bound to it because of the publisher? Or how does that work for you? I mean, what... Give us a scenario, maybe.
I think that part of it's the easiest, actually, like having gone through the process, not having two books out and seeing all the bits of it, like copy editing and you know, that we were aware of as agents are happening. But when you actually do it and feel how like each round of revision, you know, feels, you have sympathy and insight in a way that it's just impossible to have until you've gone through it. I think the hardest part for me is really just having no veil, like there's just no secrets. And in some ways it's good, because it, you know what to expect and can stay calmer, you know, in the face of good things, but the bad things too, the difficult parts of it. You have perspective, which is great, but you also, I don't know, sometimes you kind of want to be more removed, and you can't be, you know. And also just sending, when we were first sending my first book, Immaculate, out to editors who I worked with on different things and had, like, the agenting relationship with, so getting passes from them. Like, I was okay with it, but I worried they would feel more awkward. But, again, so many people in kids publishing write that it's not, you know, something they haven't been up against before.
Do you think you'll stay in, like, the YA market? Is that where you feel most comfortable right now? Because you're an awesome YA writer, and I hate to
joke
about
that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, honestly, at this point, even when I'm reading for fun, I beeline for the YA books. Like, I'm just so curious about those books. And once in a while, like, there's a few adult authors that I feel very connected to, and every time they have a new book, I need to read it. But otherwise, I don't know, just there's just so much more going on in YA. So I feel like at this point, I understand the market better. It's just more of what I see. It's more of the submissions I get, and because it is more of what I read and now what I've written, I wouldn't say I'd never. I mean, in terms of being an agent, like, I'd still love to work on adult books, but for my own, like, finding that voice, writing it, I think if it's going to happen, it's down the road. Though it's such a thin line, since so many of them are, you know, obviously crossover.
And what about, like, the new adult markets? Are you seeing a lot of submissions for that, or where do you kind of draw the line as an agent on, you know, like, hey, this really needs to be in our NA category?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a few years ago that was a big thing that everyone was very excited about, and now you just don't really see it anymore. I think it's okay to have YA books that skew a little older. Maybe it wasn't as okay back then. So I feel, you know, like they can be in college and it's still YA, or, you know. So I think there's more room to play around without necessarily putting that into a neat category.
Is it, we should give a plug for your agency here too. If you go to Jill Grinberg Literary, .com, is that what the website
mm-hmm.
is?
Yeah.
Jill Grinberg Literary.com. And also check her out on Facebook and Twitter. Are you more of a Twitter user than a Facebook, or both, or kind of copy the feed back and forth?
Yeah, as an agency, we're just on Twitter. I feel like Twitter is, yeah, kind of easier for connecting with the community at large at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm on Facebook, and I have people friend me who's not there on Facebook, but I feel like there's a lot more pictures of, like, my nephew and my mom and things like that than there are on Twitter.
Yeah, I actually like, I don't know if I should even say that, but I mean, I actually like the Twitter better than the Facebook. Everybody's like, wow, I sent you a message like a half a year ago. Are you going to respond? I'm like, I'm so sorry. I hardly ever go on Facebook. And, you know, my tweets are all copied over to the Facebook usually. Sometimes I go on there, but not enough, unfortunately. In my time, just with my day, I and I'm sure you're the same way, you just have to say, you know, this is where I have to draw the line with my social media, because you've got 80 other projects stacked, you know,
mm-hmm.
to work on. And I don't know, how do you manage your day like that? I mean, do you say, okay, from 8 a.m. to 10, this is this, and or do you just kind of go throughout the day checking email and stuff? Because when I do that, I feel like I've wasted.
Yeah, I think I'm usually just on email and then reacting to whatever comes in there. And being an agent, it's like the days, which I love about it, are just so unpredictable, because it's all really so responsive to, you know, what's coming in from your authors and editors. And every day is a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes
well, tell
a bad
us a little bit
one.
About
one.
Your book, Immaculate. Okay, so you've had that out, and now we were talking just a couple minutes prior to the show about it being the prequel. Tell us a little bit how you laid that out at first and how it is different now, and will there be a sequel to the series or to the book?
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, both books are standalone but also companion books, because they share the same characters separated by 17 years, and you can either read Immaculate first, or you can read the new one, Transcendent, and kind of learn about some of the characters in Immaculate and then go back as a prequel. But Immaculate is the story of a 17-year-old girl living in a small town in Pennsylvania, very much like mine. I mean, I really poured so much of who I was and what my town was and my friends and my family into Immaculate, the story of the 17-year-old girl who finds out that she, as a virgin, is pregnant. You know, set in our contemporary time, I was just so fascinated with the idea of how people would respond to something like this. I had asked my mom when I was a teenager if she would believe me if I was a pregnant virgin, because I love to ask obnoxious hypothetical questions like that. And she said she would, and I think that that's something that really stuck with me. And then, you know, years later, being up here working with books all the time and seeing so many retellings of, you know, fairy tales and myths and classic literature, this idea of a pregnant virgin in our modern day really, really clung to me. And just thinking about, you know, how your boyfriend would respond and your parents and your best friends and your school at large in town, but then because of social media and the internet, you know, how that would ripple out into the country and even the world, and just the different reactions people would have, the fascination and the excitement and then the hatred and the suspicion. So it was definitely a story that I think had been waiting inside me for a while that I didn't know I'd want to write. And then once the idea came back, I just had to do it. And then maybe halfway through, I started thinking about what a second book could be and if I would tell it all in one book, and thought about the baby that would be born at the end and wanting to tell their story as a teenager, finding out about all of this, which is what Transcendent became.
And I think as I was opening the show with you, you have kind of an unusual August 24th opening there. And do you want to read us an excerpt of that, of your Transcendent, and kind of bring us into the world and then tell us a little bit of why you opened there and a little bit about how you decided where to go from there with the book? I mean, you've hooked everybody, I think, in that first line, but as you know, you should.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead if you're ready. I'm sure everybody's listening and would love to hear that.
Okay. This is the prologue, and it's called Descent. Where were you the day Disney World was bombed? This is the question that will haunt my generation for the rest of our lives. The 24th of August, an awful ghoul now, still so fresh in our memories, fading into a hazier shadow that will walk beside us until the very end. Our skin will prickle as we drive by a summer carnival or see pictures of an old castle and its arching, majestic towers. When we tuck our own children into bed someday, and they ask us to read them a story filled with princes and princesses, because our fairy tale ended that day, our castles were covered in blood. This type of question is not new, of course. Each generation has its own markers, its own moments that were so devastating, so beyond comprehension, that the world stopped spinning when they first heard the news. The fundamental truths of their existence, their everyday certainties, stripped away and shredded into a million incongruous little pieces. Where were you when JFK was shot, when the planes crashed into the Twin Towers? We come together in the wake of these epic tragedies, find a bittersweet new unity that bridges any former divides. We hope for change. We promise ourselves and each other that this won't happen again, can't possibly happen again, that this time our world will be different. Then it does happen, somehow worse than the last time, despite our intentions. Our world, it is not so different after all. Humanity is predictable in its restlessness and its frustration, its ability to cause destruction, and its ability to so soon forget. But we cannot forget this. If there is a next time, if there is a grander, more terrifying next time, the world will end. It must. Because how could there be worse? How could there possibly be anything worse without our whole broken, beautiful world going up in flames? My simple answer to this question is that I was lying on a bench in Brooklyn overlooking the East River, holding an iced coffee cup to my forehead to cool my burning skin. It was a scorching August afternoon, the kind of hot that made New York feel like a city inside of a big, tightly sealed box, no holes to let in any fresh air or let any of the stale, putrid air out. But I always felt better being near the river, wide open space with no delis or apartments or stoplights, just peaceful flowing water. Water that had been there long before me would hopefully be there long after me, too. I had gone to the Riverside specifically that day because I was stressing about dumb boy problems, or more like my lack of dumb boy problems, since I had been flying completely, absolutely, not a single kiss solo for every single one of my 17 years. This summer I had hoped it was my turn, working myself up to flirt with Gabe Goodman, the sweet, soft-spoken, golden blonde violinist who had the seat next to me in summer strings camp. Gabe had been flirting too, I thought, until I'd found him by the concession stands on our camp night out to the Yankees game the weekend before, his lips, tongue, hands making music with the absurdly gorgeous red-headed cellist. I was fine. It was fine. Summer and camp were almost over anyway. I only had senior year to get through before I'd be off to Juilliard or Berkeley or Oberlin. Only a year before high school would be in the past, and I could find my real place. My eyes had just started to close, surrendering to the heat, when I heard a woman scream. I jerked up, knocking the coffee cup from my head, ice spilling over the ground. The woman was a few benches down, her face an ashy white, mouth gaping with disbelief as she stared down at her phone. Her other hand gripped the stroller at her side, pulling it in closer. Disney World? What kind of monster bombs Disney World? I grabbed for my phone, along with a handful of other people scattered along our path. What's happening? Asked one man, who had stopped mid-run, hunched over as he gasped for breath. We all looked back towards the woman, who was just now realizing that she had an audience. She stood up and plucked her little boy from the stroller before turning to face us. A series of bombs just exploded all around Disney World, Magic Kingdom. They don't know much yet, but they think thousands could be dead, thousands of. Her voice broke as she buried her face in her baby's checkered blue blanket. Thousands of children. I stood there frozen with the others, trying to make sense of those words. No one would bomb Disney World. No one was that evil. Baby started crying, his tiny face scrunched in agony. I leapt into my bike and pedaled as quickly as I could toward Park Place and my brownstone, my parents, my 10-year-old brother Caleb, those whales following me the whole way home. No matter how hard I pumped my legs, how fast and frenzied, sweat pouring down my face, my back, the ride felt like it was happening in a vacuum of slow motion. The people walking, biking, driving in cars around me seemed warped and choppy, the noises distorted, nonsensical. All I could hear were the same words looping inside my head, Magic Kingdom, bombs, thousands of children. I needed to see my family. I needed to know that my life, my bubble, was still the same as it had been that morning, the same as I had left it when I strolled out of the living room and hopped on my bike. I felt selfish, desperate, entirely alone. I pulled into the entrance for a brownstone and threw my bike down the stoop, flew up the front steps. My mom and Caleb were hunched on the floor in front of the TV when I pushed through the door, Caleb's head tucked against her shoulder as she stared straight ahead, unblinking. I collapsed on the sofa as my dad, home from work in the middle of the afternoon, walked in from the kitchen with two steamy mugs of coffee. He put the mugs down and wrapped his arms around me, but I couldn't look up. I couldn't look away. The scene playing out on the television screen was entirely unreal. It looked like something from a gruesome apocalyptic action movie, fiction, with actors and fake explosives and carefully choreographed pretend destruction. But this was the news. This was live. This was happening. Masses of people screaming and running in a chaotic crush, smudges of black and red across their faces and clothes. Smoking heaps of rubble, bits of metal and cement and paper and a thousand other things I couldn't identify and didn't want to identify, destroyed beyond any kind of recognition. Sirens, flashing lights, stretchers and bags, big black human-sized bags. The reporter was turning to interview a woman in a torn, blood-stained Snow White costume, her stage makeup smeared and bright clumps all down her face, and strands of blonde hair falling out from beneath her matted black wig. And in the background, past the carnage littered along what had once been the famed Main Street USA, I could see the crumbling remains of Cinderella Castle. The kingdom, the fairy tale, was destroyed, and in its place there was hell on earth. So that's
quite an
opening.
Yeah. That is quite an opening. We're talking to Caitlin Detweiler on her new book, Transcendent, and you can check that out at her website at katelyndetweiler.com, and that came out on October 4th in Viking, and it's a great story on a lot of levels. And you know, tell us why Disney World? Why not something else? I mean, what was so important about it being Disney World to you, or why did you pick that location?
Well, I knew before I really knew anything else about this book, except that it would be about, you know, Iris, a 17-year-old girl living in Brooklyn who has no clue of her past and this secret. that, you know, really shaped her life. I wanted the world to be at a place that was, you know, so desperate and so low that people just needed something more and something bigger and something better. And that's what, you know, kind of causes people to come and find her, because they know the story. They know the story of her mom. And for me, I mean, you know, just the way I think we all feel when we look at the news anymore. I mean, we're just jaded, and it takes a lot for us to be surprised by anything. And it takes a lot for something to really stick with us, because it's, you know, just so easily replaced by the next tragedy. That when I was thinking about this early on in it, I just thought about how I felt after Sandy Hook in particular. And, you know, when it's children, it's, you know, it's awful when it's anyone, but when it's children, it's painful in a different kind of way. And I kind of wanted to push the limits of what would actually make people stand still and to kind of, you know, snap out of this fog of, you know, just expecting more bad things to happen. Like, what would honestly be that kind of final straw? And for me, it the answer felt like Disney World.
In the book, you know, you're talking, it's got hope, it's got forgiveness, and tell us why that's important for people today. Why you wrote into the book,
mm-hmm.
Iris and using a homeless boy and Zane. And what did that mean to you? I mean, who was Zane from your past? Is that somebody that you had met at one time that gave you some hope, or, you know, was it your religion, or how did you tie all that together and create the basis for the book?
Yeah, I think, you know, Zane is more about a lot of the Brooklyn that we don't see in books. You know, I feel like Brooklyn right now, when we see it in the media, it's, and, you know, and certain parts of it, it's very true, like, are that, you know, very now rich, white, you know, as they say in the book, like, organic everything. It's this image of the hip Brooklyn that we have through the media, that when you live here, you know, you realize how much bigger of a place it really is, and how many people are here, and how tough it is for so many people, that I wanted to bring that side of Brooklyn to life in this book. But
as you said,
I mean, given how dark it starts out, I feel like I need to emphasize to people that I really, the purpose of the book is about finding light and finding hope. And it's a difficult struggle for Iris to get there. It's a real, you know, a classic coming of age, and that she has her identity completely overthrown. And that's it's early on in the book, so it's, you know, not that much of a spoiler. And her, you know, running away and just figuring out who she is, because people are expecting her to step up to the plate in a way that she doesn't feel she can, because she is just a normal human. Like, she is not special, at least in her eyes. And for me, that struggle is also thinking about the small things that all of us can do right now in the wake of, you know, reading about all these tragedies, and we internalize it, but then what can we really do? And that's something I wanted to address in thinking about those small things and the power that you can find just in, you know, connecting with people you wouldn't ordinarily connect with, and hearing stories you might not have asked to hear.
Well, you've got a wonderful story here. And is there anything you'd like to say? We're running out of time here. Is there anything you'd like to say to your fans before we close out here for the day?
No, I mean, just thank you for listening, and, you know, thank you to everyone who goes into it with an open mind. There's a lot of people who fear that it's going to be, you know, too religious or espousing some kind of message. And for me, it's not that at all. It's really thinking about how cool it could be if there's things that we can't explain in life, and just having that faith in, you know, this world and in the people we love, that sometimes we don't need science to explain everything.
Well said.
Yeah.
We're talking with Caitlin Detweiler, and you can check out her website at caitlindetweiler.com, or go to our website, bookdivas.com. We'll have everything up on the website here later on this afternoon. The archives will be available on the show link there. Check out both of her books, Transcendent, and check out her Immaculate Both. And I look forward to having you back on the show in the future on your next book. I'm sure there'll be a next book. And
thank you.
Just wishing you the best career. And a plug out to Jill Grinberg, literary.com, also your agency you work for, author by night and agent by day. And thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so very, very welcome. We'll look forward to having you back, and in the next year, maybe you'll have another book. Are you planning on doing more than one book a year, or you don't know?
No, I think just given how much I'm, you know, reading and working on the other side of things, I'd go a little crazy. But you know, I definitely have something I'm working on, so I hope it won't be too long.
Yeah, I hear you there. Well, this is Lisa, your host of Book Theaters. Sign up until next week. Thanks for guests. And that'll be Lisa Celine Davis, author of Lost Stars, back next Thursday, October 27th. Continue this Book Theaters journey.